Friends, you're listening to Irish Radio Network, USA. I'm delighted to welcome Arthur Piccolo. He is chairman of Bowling Green, of the Bowling Green Association. He is the co-founder of the Lower Manhattan Historical Society and an activist, you can believe it, an historian, and Arthur, first of all, you're very welcome.
Thank you. We forgot to mention one thing. I am also a proud, self-proclaimed honorary Irish American.
Well, yes, and you've proved it many times. There is an issue that most of us would prefer if it would simply go away. And that is, of course, the issue of representation, the history and representation in public art monuments, markers that actually was shocking to many, and then somehow, because of a lot of other issues which have come up and the focus indeed on Washington and what's happening there. Can you bring us up to date in that? Because I know that you have been very active.
Yes, very vocal. Yes,
very vocal and very active. Now, if we go back to September, Mayor Bill de Blasio, he formed this advisory commission, you know, of members to develop guidelines on how the city should really address monuments seen as oppressive. Now, even the dog in the street would say that that was really a matter of convenience because that would bring the issue past Election Day. So Election Day has come and really happening, say, in the city. And what about this this 19-person committee that was formed by the mayor?
Okay, well, first of all, I always refer to it as the so-called commission, derivatively, and there's 12 members of it. You know, this was an example of the style and the lack of substance, in my view, of our current and now for the next few years, mayor, you know, to do something. There has been complaints about particular statues, specifically Civil War statues around the country. Never, ever, to my knowledge, in the history of the United States, has a elected official put together a commission like this to supposedly identify symbols of hate that should be removed or altered from the New York City. I call it an inquisition. And it was proven just a few days ago on Wednesday when I appeared at one of their hearings and spoke. If you had been at this hearing all day Wednesday and you saw what was taking place, that the hate mongers who were telling these incredible fabrications and focusing all their attention, by the way, yes, on Christopher Columbus, I mean that he raped young African-American girls, that he slaughtered people, that he was responsible for the slave trade between Africa and America. When I spoke, my comments were going to be about the fact that the illegitimacy of the committee. I wasn't going to dignify them by talking specifically about anybody in particular, most of all Christopher Columbus. But I was forced to change my comments, because I listened to this speaker after speaker, these well-organized groups of, to be nice about it, call them dissident-type figures, who are looking for a scapegoat for all their negative views of literally all of history. And, first thing I said, do you realize, I'm very familiar with Christopher Columbus and his journeys. To my knowledge, he never even met an African American during his entire life. He certainly never, ever went near the African continent. But there was speaker after speaker getting up and talking about his specific atrocities towards African Americans. And again, Adrian, I'm fairly certain he never even met an African-American. I mean, that to me, I want to bring that up as an example of the level of this and why I told these so-called 12 commissioners sitting there that why you, this qualifies as an inquisition. It basically is very reminiscent of what we all know from the Middle Ages, where a powerful figure would appoint some of his buddies to basically take testimony that was totally spurious from a group of individuals for the purpose of condemning somebody who the powerful individual wanted to get out of the way. And I think this is a total outrage. This commission never should have existed. I think anyone who to serve on it, anyone with intelligence and integrity would never have accepted an invitation to join a so-called commission like this.
Well, you know, originally there were 19 and apparently so then at least 7 of them decided, had second thoughts about it.
Well, those were the intelligent ones.
Okay, so where is it at? Can you just bring us?
Well, where it's at now, they're going to conclude some more hearings. Supposedly, they're going to give advice to the mayor, who is going to make a determination if any particular statues should be removed or if not removed, have special signage put up to explain what they really represent in the mayor's mind. I mean, again, every time I keep making another comment, Adrian, the issue of Inquisition just keeps coming to mind. Inquisition.
Yeah.
This literally is. The idea of a particular government, and it's also reminiscent of places like China, Nazi Germany. We are basically rewriting history to serve a very specific political purpose, you know, and an agenda that has nothing to do with reality. The fact about Christopher Columbus, yes, he was a human being. Yes, he was an entrepreneur. Yes, he wanted to take care of himself and his family. But most of all, he was this incredibly brilliant explorer who was willing to risk his life to go into the unknown. The most important fact is that among historians, one of the most important, if not the most important book ever written about this is called The Columbian Connection, where this famous historian makes the case that the single most important event in all of human history was Columbus's first journey. There had been two separate places on this earth, the Americas and Eurasia, and those two bodies had never had contact for thousands of years. It was just as though they were two separate planets, and it was Columbus who brought them together and started an exchange between these two different societies that had the most dramatic change on world history of any single event in history. I pointed out to this audience of Columbus haters that one of the things that Columbus did, he came over on his first journey with various types of plants and animals that had never before been seen in the Americas. Most notable of all, and very few people realize this, the horse. There were no horses in the Americas. Columbus brought over horses, which quickly bred and spread, and it totally changed, particularly North American native culture. The tribes that had to travel no further than they could walk basically began to expand dramatically throughout North America because of the horse. The horse became the single greatest single development in the history of the indigenous people in the Americas. And these people in the audience did not have a clue about developments like this, and if they did, they did not care. The other thing was, it was the Spanish, who they had nothing to say about, who were responsible for this mass slaughter later on. There was something called the Regimiento of 1513, which was a Spanish document accepted by the Spanish and the Portuguese and others, which basically said it is okay to go into the Americas and subjugate these people, slaughter them, do whatever needs to be done on behalf of the great Spanish Empire. This happened 6 years after Columbus's death. If Columbus, I know enough about Columbus, if he had ever knew about a document like this, he would have been disgusted as much as anyone.
You ought to know, I don't think there is a more dedicated historian, and it's not, you're not, that's just not obviously the ultimate authority on Lower Manhattan. But you go back, it's close to 30 years since even skeptics would have to say that you are and you were responsible for bringing Arturo Dimarco's famous charging bull to Bowling Green. That was back in
December. It was a little bit of a month, December 20th, 1989. Of course, I'll always remember that, you know, finding Arturo after he had done this wonderful symbolic gesture of late at night, before all the barricades, of course, and all the barriers as a result of the terror attacks. He came late at night on December 16th, 1989, and placed this incredible statue of a bull under the Christmas tree at the New York Stock Exchange, and did it secretly as sort of like a Christmas gift to the people of New York City. And no one knew who had done it. It was incredible news that day. There wasn't a lot of other news going on. It was worldwide news. I came in that morning and saw it. I was overwhelmed by it, like thousands of other people were out there. But the New York Stock Exchange decided that they didn't want the bull. They hadn't given permission, and they had it illegally removed from a public street. Next day, a reporter who I identified, Arturo Dimarco, I saw his name in the New York Post. It was a Saturday. I called him, quickly got together with him. He agreed that Bowling Green would be a great spot for the bull. I called Parks Commissioner Stern then, who I knew and was friendly with, and that led to him calling Mayor Koch, who said yes, and it's been down here ever since, as of December 20th, 1989, 28 years ago.
You know, I would like also to acknowledge that you've been very influential and, again, very determined to preserve the history, to preserve particularly the history of Bowling Green. And, you know, and you
Bowling Green, what a perfect name for the park.
Yeah. And you know, we should also recognize that New York's first community created as New Amsterdam back in the 1600s.
Yep, early 1600s.
Now, there were a lot of characters, and I suppose to some degree, when you have... There were a couple that we're going to talk about, including Hercules Mulligan.
Yes, Hercules Mulligan.
Yeah, but we, you know, we're inclined, you know, to think of, you know, that you have George Washington,
mm-hmm.
You know, you have some of the great figures which kind of overshadow the great heroes, those who actually, and this is not taking anything away, obviously, from George Washington, or for that matter, any of the well-known characters. But, you know, talk about Bowling Green for openers, and then... You know, the entree to New York and what kind of role that played in, you know, in American history.
Well, Bowling Green very much was, you know, New Amsterdam then becoming in 1664 and 1666 New York when the British took over. Bowling Green was the town square of New York City, you know, throughout the 16th and the 17th. It was, just like in any other small town, it was the town square. It's where everything took place. It's where everyone met each other. It was where the markets was. It was demonstrations took place. It was absolutely the center of the city. It was the center of the city initially because of the fact that Fort Amsterdam was built right at the tip. Battery Park is all landfill, so the shoreline was right here. And the area in front of the fort was, in fact, the area that became the most popular spot. And that was, before it was called Bowling Green, it was the parade grounds and the market area in front of the fort. And skipping around a little to make my points, in 1733, Bowling Green became a park, and it became named Bowling Green. Bowling Green became an official New York City park. Now, what is so amazing about that, Adrian, March 12, 1733, when the city council, which is the same city council, was then called the Common Council, but the city council we have today, named a park It was an absurd idea, if you think about it. There were hundreds of millions of acres out there that was, you know, that in effect was parkland at that point. Why would anybody build a park? No other colony built a park and declared a park in 1733. The reason was that the colonists wanted a maintained, manicured surface to play the only sport that they had in those days, which was lawn bowling. So in order to get this manicured surface where they could play high-quality lawn ball, they wanted a park to be maintained by the city, and that was the whole basis. So you could also say the Bowling Green was the first sort of ballpark in all of America, which would also be true.
Yeah.
And then in 1770, the British, at the urging of the colonists, after the repeal of the Stamp Act, they put a statue of the King of England on a horse, you know, in this glorious pose, in the very middle of Bowling Green Park, which today where the fountain is for all those who are familiar with Bowling Green. Turns out that very quickly the colonists became once again disappointed with British rule, and they began vandalizing the statue. So what the British did in 1771 is they built an iron fence to surround the park so they could control the park. And the vandalism continued because there were crowns on the fence and the colonists knocked the crowns off. The British next closed the park. They closed it. They locked it. It has entrances. And the colonists were kept away from the park until July 9th, 1776, when word of the Declaration of Independence first reached New York City, where George Washington was on a messenger on a horse, came up. And the first official act of the American Revolution took place right here in New York City at Bowling Green, when the colonists, after the reading of the Declaration, smashed into the park and destroyed that statue. And although I'm getting a little bit ahead of where you want to go, the individual who led the colonists into the park to destroy the statue was one of the leaders of the famous Sons of the Revolution, Hercules Mulligan.
Hercules Mulligan, history will record that he was, well, I'm sure that the British history books would say he was an outright spy, but let's acknowledge before we get into that story that he came from Ireland. He was born in 1740 and
Corrine County, Londonderry, Ireland.
Yeah. Now, he came as a businessman, as a tailor, or did he learn that trade?
No, let me just give you a little more precise view of. He was born on September 25th, 1740. He and his family came to New York City 6 years later in 1746. So almost his entire life was spent. He was 6 years old when he arrived here in New York City. All right, and as he grew up, he went to what was the major college here, King's College, which is now Columbia. King's College became, he graduated from King's College. And then, a few years later, after doing some other types of jobs as an accountant and those things, decided to become a tailor. But I don't want to get ahead of the story, because that is not where the Hercules Mulligan story begins. It begins with his activities as one of the founding members of the Sons of the Revolution, which was the famous group that formed and played an important part in the days leading up to the revolution. I also have a theory, which you're very familiar with, which cannot be disproven as much as it can't be proven yet. Hopefully it will be. On March 17th, 1762, at Bowling Green, the first ever anywhere on earth public demonstration for St. Patrick's Day took place, as you know, right here at Bowling Green and up and down Lower Broadway. It was led by Irishmen who had been conscripted into the British Army and forced to come to New York City as part of the British occupation. And on that day, they and colonists marched up and down in defiance of the British. What is not known is who motivated this, whose idea was. Well, I can make the strong case that Hercules Mulligan, who by 1762 and was in his early 20s, was already known for his revolutionary spirit and activities, and knowing his later history, I think my theory is that hopefully it will someday be proven that Hercules Mulligan may well have been the source for the idea of the very first St. Patrick's Day march, which, of course, then went on to become a worldwide phenomenon, the St. Patrick's Day Parade.
You know, we discussed that at great length, and we could spend, you know, a long time on that. And I, but I would like, though, to, on Hercules Mulligan, how then did he, as, you know, as a tailor, as a clothier, as we say tailor, but actually I assume his parents, that he inherited that business. His parents were in the clothing business as tailors. How did he then fly under the radar? Because his entire business was just not catering to the British, but the wealthy British businessmen and the high-ranking military officers, they thought very highly of Hercules Mulligan. How did he maneuver around that, if in fact he was a revolutionary?
Well, yeah, that's interesting, and I think it's another example of his brilliance and his persuasiveness. First of all, his family was not involved in that trade. He basically, when he finished college, he went to work for his father in an accounting clerk capacity,
yeah.
And it appears he was not happy with that. And where he learned his tailoring skills, whether as an apprentice, there isn't necessarily a lot of precise information, but once he decided to become a tailor, he apparently struck everyone as a very good tailor, and all the most prominent people in the city, and particularly the British occupiers, the wealthy British supporters here who were business people, but most notably, as you said, the high-ranking British officers started
right.
to use him regularly for their tailoring needs, their uniforms, and the like. Now, that is fascinating in that Hercules Mulligan, who had been widely known as a revolutionary figure, was then accepted by the British. And his rationale that he was no longer interested in the revolution, he didn't want any part of it, he was going to care about his business and you know, leave that to somebody else. He was obviously very persuasive in that. And the facts are indisputable. Hercules Mulligan sent regular, first of all, we have to back up for a second. We have to bring up the name of Alexander Hamilton in all of this. Alexander Hamilton came to the United States, to the colonies, a few years before 1776, as a young teenager. He arrived in New York City. He knew nobody. The Mulligan family embraced him, particularly Hercules and his brother. They were instrumental in first getting him accepted to a college for young people in New Jersey, which is now Princeton University, but quickly gaining that revolutionary fervor from his contacts with Hercules. He came to New York City, and again, with Hercules' help, also enrolled in King's College. But Hercules Mulligan, by many, is credited for motivating Hamilton's interest in the revolution.
Yeah.
But they continued as lifelong friends, and what happened was, obviously, Hamilton was involved with the war from day one, once it took place, and he was still in communications with Hercules Mulligan and, in effect, recruited Hercules Mulligan as a very effective spy for Washington and the Continental Army and the Congress in Philadelphia. And his input as a spy was absolutely indispensable. Two ways. Well, there were many ways, but two that I want to note here without going too deeply into it. There were plots, needless to say, by the British to assassinate, to kill Washington. Had they been successful in those plots, the American Revolution would have absolutely fallen apart and it would have been the end of it without Washington's unique leadership. It was Hercules Mulligan with these British officers coming in and thinking he was one of them talking freely in his tailor shop who uncovered, as a result of their chatter at his tailor shop, of what was going on. But even more importantly, Adrian, on a certain level, it was he who learned about the fact that the British decided to make their best thrust to end the revolution, not in New York City, as Washington was preparing for, but down in Yorktown. And it was, in fact, in the Hamilton play. That's what Mulligan has gotten a certain amount of fame lately because he is in the great Hamilton musical. But the part where Mulligan comes into the play as a figure is the fact where he notifies Alexander Hamilton and the Americans that, in fact, the British are going to make this great stand to end the revolution in Yorktown, which allows Washington to redirect his attention there and to get the help of the French. And obviously, that was the end of the war and the successful conclusion of the American Revolution. And absolutely, Hercules Mulligan, in that way, played an instrumental role in the successful conclusion of the American Revolution.
You know, an interesting aside, but we can only imagine, you know, he was obviously, he was good at what he did. His association, you know, within the circles of the wealthy British officers and indeed in society at the time, it was quite acceptable for him to marry the niece of Admiral Sanders of the Royal Navy. Boy, that must have been, you know, that must have been a story and a half. I wonder how the domestic situation worked out there.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think the history books will spend much time on that. So we.
But you know something that's far more significant, and this was Washington paid Hercules Mulligan the greatest possible honor in this way. The American Revolution, although it ended practically with the Battle of Yorktown, in effect, British continued to occupy New York City. And the British Union Jack continued to fly over New York City at Bowling Green. It was only days from today, on November 25th, 1789, that Washington gloriously entered New York City to watch the very last British troops leave from American soil to go back to Britain, and the very last British flag being lowered that was still flying in these United States. And he came down. It's called Evacuation Day. We still celebrate it finally again. It was used to be a very big holiday.
Yeah.
And came down Broadway to witness the British troops leaving and the British flag coming down and the American flag. At that very same time, he went very publicly to have breakfast with Hercules Mulligan at his home. This was his very public way, and Hamilton, you know, Washington was not the kind of person who made that kind of gesture going to people's homes often for things like breakfast, but he made it a point of going to Hercules Mulligan's home here in Lower Manhattan to have breakfast with him.
Hercules Mulligan, that's the least he could have done, show up for breakfast.
Well, come on. I know you're being a little bit facetious here, but the fact is, by having breakfast with him, what he actually did on a practical level, he basically anointed him as an incredibly important individual, and his tailoring business flourished even more, even with the British gone at that point.
Yeah, but wait a minute. He saved General George Washington's backside twice.
Yes.
So again, he was. An amazing character. I would like you to talk a little bit about Alexander Hamilton.
As long as we return to Hercules Mulligan before the end of this conversation.
All right. Okay.
All right. Alexander Hamilton, go ahead.
He was an accountant who probably would have, you know, been happy enough to stay in that, or am I correct on that one? Except that the revolution was kind of a secret society at the time, or as an historian, correct me if that's wrong.
No, I think it was quite public in the years. I mean, as I pointed out, the British, although they were occupying New York City, had to put up this big fence, which, by the way, is still at Bowling Green. Parts
right.
of it are still up. But they, I mean, it was very public. They were vandalizing British property. They were starting fires. There was a lot of insurrection. 1770, there was this great Stamp Act demonstration in New York City when the British had instituted the Stamp Act, which was the largest demonstration anywhere in the colonies up to then, and that was in 1770. So it was very public, Adrian, what was going on. There was the British, you know, were, in fact, the British evacuated New York City shortly before the Declaration of Independence because they did not want to have to confront the colonists anymore. They thought it was better for them to retreat out of New York City for the time being and marshal their resources outside of the city's borders.
Hamilton, again, one of America's founding fathers, became the first Secretary of the Treasury and appointed by George Washington. And, you know, he definitely played such a significant role in our American history. Coming back, as you reminded me, to Hercules Mulligan, he somehow, among, you know, when we talk about the founding fathers and we talk about, you know, all of the great well-known heroes at the time, we have to, it takes an historian like yourself, you know, to uncover not only Hercules Mulligan, but the influence of those, you know, who were right under the noses of the British at the time. And what was their, you know, I know they retreated, they decided to get out of here, it wasn't worth the trouble. But what was the relationship, you know, with the revolutionaries and the, you know, the British, say, the military at the time? It's Hercules Mulligan seems to be the exception to the rule.
Well, I think what you've identified, and again, I could have brought this up earlier, the fact that Hercules Mulligan did not flee with a lot of the colonists during the time after the American Revolution and after Washington's loss of the Battle of Long Island and his escape from New York City, most of the revolutionary, in fact, all of the revolutionary types, I assume, also got out of the city because the British came back soon after the Declaration of Independence and reoccupied Manhattan Island. Hercules Mulligan was still here doing his tailoring. And I think that was an incredibly significant reason that the British did not doubt his change of heart about the American Revolution. This guy who had been very much a revolutionary, for him to stay here was basically a sentence of death when the British returned if they really thought he was still with the revolutionary group. And he obviously pulled off the fact of convincing them that he was not.
Yeah. That brings us to a project. First of all, I forgot to mention, and I should, you know, that in addition to bringing the world-famous Charging Bull to Bowling Green, the installation of the second large flag pole at
yes.
Bowling Green, organized by yourself, but that was donated by the Greek community.
That was donated by the Greek community, and again, another example, current example, if you will, of the nature of government today. Quickly, I don't want to focus on any off the main subject, but quickly, 1996, the Greeks wanted to, there were a lot of Greek business people, particularly coffee shop and lunch shop owners, who knew me and said, you know, we want to raise our flag. There's a flagpole at Bowling Green. We want to raise our flag just for one day in honor of Greek independence. I believe it was the 175th anniversary that year of Greek. And even though Henry Stern by that was my dear friend, and commissioner. He said, no, we always have to fly the American flag from that flagpole. I can't allow you to take it down even for one day and fly another nation's flag. So he said to me facetiously, if your friends are, I've been asking about this again and again and again. He says, if your Greek friends are that interested, tell them to go out and buy a second flagpole. You know, and this is a week before March 25th of 1996, which would have been the anniversary.
Yeah.
And I went back to the Greek Federation, my friends there, and I said, the park commissioner told me if you want to donate enough money for flagpole, and without going into all the details, and there's a lot of details here, they raised overnight $15,000, and there was unbelievably a 55-foot flagpole that the flag company had, and we got it in. There's a lot more to the story. I don't want to get totally focused on it, maybe some other time. But the point is that we, since that donation, We have had hundreds of flag raising ceremonies, and in fact, my involvement with the Irish community, which I hope is significant and growing, began as a result of flying an Irish flag here, you know, going to a consulate and going to Irish leaders and saying, we have a second flagpole. Why don't we fly the Irish flag here?
And you did, and it was a very memorable occasion. And you also, you know, organized the annual July 4th parade in Lower Manhattan, and if I may say so, because you know, I was the first recipient of the Alexander Hamilton Award.
Achievement Award, specifically given to outstanding immigrants who have come to America in the spirit of Alexander Hamilton.
Well. Thank you, and I take that in the spirit in which it's offered. But let me just ask you, though, about your drive, your push, you know, for a very significant, which would be a dream, to name the footbridge at the...
let me start from the beginning. Yeah. Let me start, because this is the most important part of the conversation. I hope you agree. The fact is, Hercules Mulligan, a lot of people of lesser accomplishment than Hercules Mulligan have public recognition by way of a public honor in this city, you know, but Hercules Mulligan has been largely ignored. I call Hercules Mulligan the first great Irish-American revolutionary, and I think that characterizes his importance based on our conversation so far. There has been, and I'm so excited about this, it tells you where my focus is. I mean, this is always on my mind now. There has always been, since the Brooklyn Battery Tunnel was built, there's always been a footbridge going from one side of Lower Manhattan to the other, and it was an old bridge, and I never gave a second thought to it except to use it. Nobody else gave a second thought. The idea of naming it would never have come up to anybody. But in recent weeks, that bridge has been taken down, and a brand new footbridge is being constructed right now. And passing it a couple of weeks ago, I said to myself, you know, this is worthy of having a name attached to it. And the first name that automatically came to my mind, somebody who has not gained recognition, Hercules Mulligan. You know, I have to tell you that in terms of Mulligan's accomplishments, the CIA has a special page dedicated to Hercules Mulligan as America's first great spy. And I have to tell you, you have to allow me to read the very last lines of their tribute to him, and they relate it to July 4th. So this July, 4th of July, while you gaze upon busts in red, white, and blue color exploding in the night sky, think about those lesser-known heroes. Think about the men and women whose small contributions made large impacts on the founding of this great nation. Think of Hercules Mulligan. That is the way the tribute to Hercules Mulligan is, and it basically addresses this issue directly. You know, think about this forgotten hero. And I think with this footbridge, it's simply a footbridge, I think this footbridge can become a very imaginative way of honoring Hercules Mulligan, and in fact, the entire history of the Irish American community in New York City by naming it in his honor. So I am dedicated. I hope you are dedicated. I hope others inside and outside of the Irish community will be dedicated to a bridge that no one would have ever named until I came up with the idea that this new footbridge, and I obviously I'm not going to go into the details, which I think can follow. We can do that off radio. But I think the idea of a footbridge becoming a significant, a notable, a well-utilized monument, I think, is an intriguing concept, and without going into the details, because I don't want to spoil the rest of the story, I think it can become a truly incredible, this simple footbridge, a wonderful, memorable, long-lasting monument to Hercules Mulligan, if we can get it done. All that will take, it could be done in a lesser way, but one way that all it will take is that the governor of the state just simply has to say, yes, indeed, a bridge without a name, Hercules, the great Hercules Mulligan, where do I sign? And that is how simple as it should be.
Okay. And when you called me on this and you were talking about working from the top down rather than the bottom up before the bridge, you know, before the footbridge, you know, becomes, you know, just one more footbridge in New York City, I reached out to, you know, to some people who had access to the governor's office, and they said nobody knows who this guy is. Nobody knows anything about him. And you know, to that end, the interest level coming from the governor, coming, you know, from Albany, will be next to nil. And I couldn't help but say, well, if there is that, if there's such little interest in something and nobody is lining up to name the footbridge to begin with, well, maybe that's...
Adrian, on this one, I'm going to have to debate you publicly on radio. The fact is not, no, there is definitely awareness of Hercules Mulligan within the community of those who take the time and interest to know about such things. I went into the history of the American Irish Historical Society,
right,
and at their annual event back in 1926, one of the speakers' entire dissertation before that large, prestigious audience back in 26 is Hercules Mulligan is not getting the honor and recognition he deserves. By the way, the American Irish Historical Society is absolutely, I spoke with the executive director, they are absolutely behind this. The Sons of the Revolution are behind this. You know, the people, anyone who's telling you two things. One, who cares about Hercules Mulligan? They're just ignorant of history.
Right.
Second of all, the whole point here is to take a place that no one would care about. If that's the case, if no one cares, then why not care to name it for Hercules Mulligan? The fact is, this footbridge, which would never, ever have a name, had someone, in this case me, come up with the idea. So if you don't want to name something more important, if you don't want to put his name on something of truly, in their mind, a significance, fine with me, and I hope fine with you.
Absolutely.
This unnamed bridge, give it to Hercules Mulligan. But the idea that the CIA, I just read the CIA, no one, they have a CIA that has a page, permanent page on their website, recognize Hercules Mulligan as America's first great spy. I don't think that is somebody that we should not care about.
Arthur,
let me say one more thing, Adrian, and please don't cut me off the show for saying this, you know, and I'm being totally truthful here. You are one of the most highly respected, widely known individuals in the Irish American community today in America, and specifically in New York City. I believe you attaching your name and taking an active interest in it will absolutely be a catalyst to make sure that this does happen, and it happens by early in the new year.
Okay. Now, that's how I got in trouble practically the day I met you, you know, is that whereas you're very gracious and laudatory, but that comes with a price. So now I'm stuck in the middle of this. And
you'll be as proud as anybody the day we have that dedication ceremony, and there's this huge crowd at the Hercules Mulligan Bridge. It's going to be something that's going to be memorable.
Having been, you know, resoundingly rejected by the couple of people that I thought at least might carry this message to Albany. Let me ask, how do we get involved? And I really don't want to under, I want to make it very clear, I'm not undertaking, this project. I will most definitely, and I've done so hopefully this morning, I'm on board. But how do we nail this to a central point where, we can get the information, where we can find out what the process is, other than getting in touch with me, because I'm going to change my phone number.
Oh, you're not in.
I'm going to change my number again.
I'm sure you don't want your audience to do that. But Adrian, in quotes, it's easy. You and I, right now, right here on your show, nothing legal about this, no filling out forms. You and I are right now, right here, forming an ad hoc committee for the Hercules Mulligan Bridge, okay? And what we will allow and urge and hope anyone who has any interest to also allow their names to be part of this ad hoc committee.
Okay.
And we obviously want prominent people, Irish and not Irish, but we want lots of people. They do not have to be prominent. And with this ad hoc committee, I believe we'll display the kind of interest that will get this done. By the way, there's always ironies. The fact is, the best thing the governor could do to score a few extra points with the Irish community is to do this. It costs him nothing. There's no cost involved whatsoever. There's no downside. He basically gets lots of good press in the Irish media and elsewhere, and if he's really smart about it, shows up at the dedication ceremony, gets widely applauded. You know, this is a gift to the governor of the state of New York. This is a Christmas gift to the governor of the state of New York, and I'm being serious about that. An easy opportunity, no downside, no cost of financial or otherwise, to score points with the Irish community, and he's up for re-election next year.
Okay. All right. Can we direct those who may be interested, and there's no cost to the government, there's no cost to us as an Irish American community, and indeed listeners to this program, where do we go with this?
Well, are you asking for a contact person?
I'm asking for a contact person other than myself.
I will gladly allow give my email address for anyone who expresses any interest and
okay.
wants to get on board. It's simply art, as in art, A-R-T, Piccolo, P as in Peter, I-C-C-O-L-O, just like the instrument, at earthlink.net. artpiccolo@earthlink.net. They can also call me on my message line. I'm probably not going to pick up on this line, but I will get my messages and I will get back to you at 212-809-4615. That's 212-809-4615. I promise anyone who either emails me or calls me, I guarantee I will get back to them.
Okay, that's artpiccolo at earthlink.net. 212-809-4615.
Yes, it is.
All right. Thanks, Arthur. And
Adrian, thank you. It's always a pleasure and an honor to be able to get on your show and express ideas like this.
Geez, I have to tell you, though, that, anytime I talk to you, I have this vision of your being a fisherman, and that you have that hook that generally catches me right in the gob,
And I hope that pleases you.
All right, thank you. And thanks for listening to Irish Radio Network, USA.